This is The Guardian.
Regid Ahmed here on Gadigal land with the full story. This summer, one of the oldest and fiercest rivalries in sport continues as England take on Australia in the Ashes. It's a contest that's been going on for more than 140 years, and this time it takes place on Australian soil. Australia have had the upper hand in recent times, but England will try to reverse that streak as they attempt to win a test match in Australia for the first time in almost 15 years. To help you follow all the action, we'll be replaying episodes of the Guardian Ashes weekly podcast throughout the summer.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Ashes Weekly, supported by Qantas, the spirit of Australia. So that's it then, a series of under-preparation of two-day tests of the worst Australian team for years, of England's all-out pace attack slowly disappearing one by one. A series of Travis Head, a series of bowling short and wide to Travis Head, a series of Snicko, of Australia taking ridiculous catches, of England dropping them, a series of Bazball without brains, of Jamie Smith getting an unplayable one from Marnus, a series of if they just batted properly in that second innings at Perth, a series of Noosa, a series of Mitchell Stark, of Alex Carey standing up, a last one for Uzzy, a series of Pat Cummings just popping up once to remind us how good he is, a series of ignoring county cricket, a series with an England win, a series of Joe Root getting an Aussie ton, of Ben Stokes doing everything all the time and slowly falling apart, and finally, maybe a series of hope. Not too much pressure, but how many Guardian Ashes weeklies in the future will be about Jacob Bethell single-handedly winning it all for England? Probably none, but it's nice to dream. I'm Max Rushton, and this is the Guardian Ashes Weekly. On the panel today, the Guardian cricket correspondent, Ali Martin. Hey, Ali.
Hello, Max. Hello, everyone.
Our chief sports writer, Barney Ronay.
Hello, everyone.
And the Guardian's Emma John. Hey, Emma.
Hi.
And Guardian Australia's Jeff Lemon. All right, Jeff.
Hi, Max.
So, Australia win the fifth test by 5 wickets. On the fifth day, they win the series 4-1. Again, from an England perspective, it was a test that gave and took away. I mean, there is lots of time for the inquest, which will sound like a lot of the other episodes, Ali. Should we start with Jacob Bethell, just for a moment of happiness? Such a brilliant, proper cricket, test cricket innings.
It was a sensational innings. It felt like a... And I was there kind of innings, you know, and you don't get too many of those along the way. And with all due respect to some past centurions that I've seen in Australia, this one did feel different. It felt like something for the future. It felt like a sort of prophecy realised with all the talk from Sobers and Lara while he was growing up in Barbados and before he moved over to England. He is the one. He is a fantastic player. It's all shapes and angles. He looks so comfortable on the back foot. It's that high elbow. And it was just a pure, pure innings. And it is one of the very few where, you know, everyone in the press box, we're sitting there watching him construct this thing of beauty, and everyone is purring. I mean, I just, you know, you're listening to gnarled old former Aussies who don't give these things out easily, just sort of, you know, absolutely praising. And I know that Barney even had a former fast bowler next to him in the urinal saying lovely things as well. About Jacob Bethell, I should say.
Of course.
But it was a lovely innings. And a little bit too late from England's point of view because, I'd probably put myself in the camp of people that thinks that England really should have invested in him 12 months ago. New Zealand was the sign that he had these gifts and the English summer was the time to invest in him. England slightly blinked on that front. Better late than never in some respects. And it does mean that unlike Joe Root, he will never go back to Australia being told how many test matches he's played there without 100. Sensational.
And Barney, I thought you were going to say Barney had a tear in his eye. I was like, well, that is a step too far, of course. But he does bat, Barney, with a sort of Gower-esque elegance, doesn't he?
No, I don't think so.
You don't think so?
He's left-handed, but he doesn't remind me of Gower particularly.
Fine,
Gower
was kind of...
Gower didn't really move his feet. He was kind of like willowy wrists and stuff like that. The thing about Bethell is his defensive technique is really orthodox and really good. And you can really see when he bats you can see when he fields as well, what a very good athlete he is, because he moves so late. He has no trigger and his feet are incredibly quick. His wrists are incredibly quick and he gets into those positions really quick. And we're all noting, even the way he evades a bouncer, is old school. Like he wrenches his his kind of waist back.
Like Gower?
Well, like Robin Smith. I've seen Robin Smith start. Okay. It's an aggressive leave, but it's keeping your eyes on the ball, which I like. And it's kind of, it's the way people used to leave the ball before they had helmets, I think, more. There's less ducking because you wanted to keep your eyes on it. And it's very exciting. It's like an alpha statement of athleticism. It's like, this is what I do to your bouncer. And Ali's right. I had a lovely moment at the urinal, with a former Australian great. And, but everybody just gets him immediately. At this point, you're meant to say it's going to be tall poppies and we put so much pressure on these people. But I actually just think he's really good and he knows it and he's never hidden his own confidence and succession planning is good. He's already had the White Bull captaincy and who knows, he might save us from the Harry Brook reign. You never know, it's still possible.
Jeff, does he bring fear? I mean, you don't really mind. I guess you just want to see good cricket, but...
Well,
are you nervous about how many he'll win for us?
I was delighted to see him play properly, and there is a lot of talk of that, and I'm sure there'll be some retconning of how different things might have been if he'd been there from the start. But I also don't think he would have been allowed to play that innings if he'd played the first test, because the way that England fundamentally approached the series was different during the first test. There was that sort of everybody all in, charge, don't worry about the consequences kind of approach that brought everything unstuck at Perth and Brisbane. So I think the timing worked out for him to be able to play the way that he did, you know, come in during Melbourne when it was absolute chaos and nobody really noticed. And he was getting quite a bit of praise for having made 10 in Melbourne because it was a good looking 10, you know, he looked solid for a minute when others didn't, but this was the opportunity to play that knock, which wouldn't have been there in much different conditions with the ball rising at him much more sharply in Perth. Maybe he would have played a better one in Perth. Maybe he would have done a teenage Sachin innings in Perth. I don't know. But I think that it worked out for him. It didn't work out for England in terms of him being able to have an impact on the series. And I think that it's probably right that they should have moved on Pope a long, long time ago. But that's not the way they ended up doing it.
And still, Emma, you know, this test match had all the England moments of frustration. You know, there's Bethel and then Will Jacks comes in after that stand before and second ball. You're like, Will, that's not you. That's what Jamie Smith is meant to do. Jamie Smith has already done that in the first innings to Marnus, you know, and you also had what you had in so many times in this series is just England getting the new ball and just unable to build any pressure whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, this really, in terms of the bowling, this was kind of, this, it really felt like the end of a series, didn't it? And it was kind of the worst. I mean, luckily, you know, by this point, it really doesn't make any difference because people are only playing for pride. It's like, I feel like it's really unfair to like pick out Matthew Potts and to like go, oh, well, this was kind of the worst bowling of the series because obviously he's coming in to a team that hasn't allowed him to, play beforehand. Honestly, I felt like this was kind of, apart from the Bethel innings, as an England fan, apart from the Bethel innings, this was a real kind of be careful what you wish for test match for me, because after all of the two-day games and the short ones, there were moments when this test match just felt like it was going to go on forever, even though to me, an England defeat seemed inevitable from the moment that they were 57 for three in the first innings. And yes, I know that, you know, Root stepped in to get them to 226 for three, and that was marvellous as well. And hooray, hooray for another Joe Root century in a losing cause. But, you know, all the time he was there, Harry Brook was playing pretty unnecessary shots at the other end, which he ended up getting out to one, an unnecessary one to Scott Boland, so did Jamie Smith. It really just proves that even at this stage when the pressure was off, they cannot change their approach. I've heard people say, oh, they can't change their gears. They don't have another gear. They're a single speed bike, basically.
And Ali, just on the bowling, like I just feel like I've seen Brydon Carse bowl short and wide to Travis Head, and then just any one of the commentators on either Fox or Channel 7 or whatever channel I happen to be watching just saying, that's exactly where Travis Head wants it. I've just seen that so many times in the last 2 months.
I know. They fed his cut shot to the point of, you know, that cut shot is probably now on a January diet or sort of Googling a Zempic. You know, it's been fed so much over the last two months. Is it 2 months? It feels longer.
I don't know. 6 weeks.
Six weeks, 7 weeks, yeah. Something like that. The bowling. Yes, that, and that has been the story of Brydon Carson's tour, which he's, I think we mentioned it last week, he's had a crazy tour, loads of wickets, he's a Lionheart, he charges in, he just keeps coming, and he does have a knack of taking wickets, but my word, he sprays it. He isn't a new ball bowler, he's been thrust into that role because of injuries, and his, you know, he really is a kind of a change bowler, and a shock bowler. It was funny seeing him on the last day kind of snarling and spitting and, you know, getting really worked up by that snicko. And, yeah, he's someone who doesn't give up. I think the one main positive for England has been Josh Tung, not the emergence of Josh Tung. He's been around a little while, but he, for a player that possibly didn't have as much self-belief as others going into this series, I think that he will leave this tour now fully believing that he's a test match bowler. He asks questions of the best players. He's got the angle, he's got the pace, and he seems to have the hardiness as well, you know, to get through long spells, particularly picking up the slack after Ben Stokes went off. So Tung was the positive, Cast was a curio, and poor Matt Potts not much to speak of, other than to say two things. One, he got the run out of minus at the end, so he did walk away with something to show for it. And two, he was the only England player in the entire series who wasn't dismissed by Mitchell Starc. So he should really be looking around the dressing room going, boys, any danger?
Jeff?
He's also about the only player who didn't end up with a batting average in the 20s for the series because he was not out and managed to hit a few and looked okay. I mean, I don't think you can be too hard on Potts because that can happen. You know, you can have a bad test match. Everybody else across the series, I mean, the cast inaccuracy thing was such a consistent theme across the series. And you can pile into the bowling attack, but they were also badly captained at times. You know, Stokes gets a lot of praise for being innovative as a captain, but he missed a lot of tricks during this series, and things like going to a bouncer field with a ball that's 14, 15 overs old, that kind of thing. We were vaguely satirical for years about it being Broad, Anderson, Wokes showing up again and again, but at least those players knew what they were supposed to do with the ball, even if it wasn't working, whereas that lack of experience really seemed to tell. You know, Archer got it right by Adelaide, but most of the other players were just so inaccurate that they weren't able to put pressure on. And like you say, the amount of short bowling was just wasted short bowling. It wasn't full bouncer ploy. It was just hanging back of a length, and that was something that just happened so consistently that Australia got away with it.
Mm. And Barney, I mean, I suppose from a bowling perspective, it does seem like if all you have to do is pitch it up, and that's all you have to do, but it seems so obvious, right? And maybe it is much harder technically to do that. And we are, you know, this may not be Australia's primary attack, but you have bowlers who are just metronomic like that. And we didn't have that.
I mean, the bowling short thing is, the two things are related. And it's because there's a massive margin for error when you just bang it into the pitch and you've gone four overs, none for 27, trying to bowl in the correct area. It's a defensive ploy because, well, captaincy is kind of an illusion, isn't it? Captaincy means you've got good bowlers. I mean, for ages, you could just say, well, he's a brilliant captain. He brought on Glenn McGrath. Like, he could have known that would work, or Shane Warne. I mean, I'm not like a big Stokes guy. I mean, I'm not one of those people who believe everything he does is correct, but his captaincy seems to go up and down in his ratings depending on how good or bad the bowlers are at his command, sort of like everyone. But I just think so much comes into the fact that bowlers weren't fit, didn't prepare, and bowling is incredibly difficult mechanical action. Bowling a ball from a height of whatever you are, 6 foot seven, that's going to hit the stumps and is going to be 84, 85 miles an hour. People underestimate how difficult cricket is. Cricket is really difficult. What Scott Boland is doing is kind of a miracle. Like, it's his level of control, bowling in that can't drive, can't play back slot. It's so aggressive. It's so hostile. It's so relentless. That's really hard to do. And Potts, when he came in, hadn't played since September in a proper game. How is he supposed to do that with the adrenaline pumping? It's just impossible. You've given him it's essentially an impossible task. That should be asterisked from his record. And he did really well to just keep coming in, because it could have been a kind of mental collapse when he's heading for the... He was challenging Mike Atherton's most expensive bowling performance ever for an Englishman at one point. And the fact he pulled it back, I think I have newfound respect for Potts. And when I was standing next to him at the urinal the other day, he said the same thing to me. I can't bring that in. It happens a lot.
Yeah, I found that I spent a lot of the test match just feeling sorry for a lot of people. I don't know whether that's kind of a common thing of like, you know, when a series isn't live at the last test and we all know how tired we are just from our, doing our jobs for the last 6 weeks. It must be so, they must be really, really exhausted. And I just found myself just welling up with empathy, whether it was for Potts, for Stokes. I feel really sorry for Stokes. I think he is the ultimate competitor, the ultimate never say die guy. He goes out there, he does it all himself, and he just hasn't, people just haven't come with him.
He certainly made that clear, hasn't he, with his you wouldn't guess it, would you? Like, do you think he feels that at all? I mean, there is this performative aspect to the Warrior King, you know, the straw the kind of incredible swept back bearded man. Do you ever feel that maybe the kind of show of that is not helpful?
I think it's completely fair for it to come out. Like, I think if anything, people are saying that he hasn't got on.
He hasn't grimaced enough, if anything. He hasn't. He's almost grimaced too well.
He is just a grimace. That's it. It's just a human grimace.
He also didn't need to bowl, you know, 25 overs in a row and decide to do that himself and then surprise, surprise, end up with a muscle strain, because that's what happens every time he does a bowling spell like that. He also averaged 18 for the series, which was worse than any of his specialist batting teammates. So was he really let down?
That's
was he hard done by?
He stayed out there. He stayed out there. There were times when he was sticking out in the middle when nobody else was sticking with him.
He spent 3 years saying there's no point staying out there and not scoring runs, and the whole point of our philosophy is that we're not going to bother doing that anymore. We're not going to be defensive losers like those guys in the past who just stayed out there not scoring. They haven't advanced the position of the team, is what he would say. They haven't moved the game along, and now he's the guy who did that and averaged 18 for the series. So was he actually
any
good?
Yeah, but he's had an epiphany, Jeff. He's had an epiphany. He told the BBC yesterday that playing sport is about winning. And that is not something that, you know, was the thing that he thought in 2022, was it? It wasn't about winning. And now it is about winning. Right. So he's developed.
As a Cambridge United, Tottenham, England football, England cricket team, I would say sport is definitely not about winning. Mm. Ali, but Stokes is still the guy, right? Ali, Stokes is still the man to lead this team.
I mean, it certainly looks like it. It does look like, I mean, he's weirdly walks away from an Ashes defeat, 4-1 down, probably emboldened to a degree because of everything else that's kind of collapsing around him. There has been a sort of existential philosophical breakdown on this tour, and I don't know how they're going to recover that in the next sort of few months. There is a bit of time before the next test series, but him and McCullum are really going to have to sit down and have some proper conversations about how they're going to run this thing. What actually is the outlook here? Because there's been times over the course of the series that they seem to have gone in different ways. But there is, you know, I guess it's partly a lack of credible alternatives. It's partly because Stokes, the all-rounder, yes, I know that he disappointed with the bat here, but he is still one of England's sort of best four seam bowlers. And that will be the case probably for the next couple of years, which is when he's contracted to. And it's hard to see him dropping back down into the ranks as a player. And it's hard, you know, I think he will remain as captain, and his vice captain is, I'm sure we're going to come onto it, because his vice captain is, he's got his own issues. But yes, when Harry Brooks stepped up and captained on that fourth morning, one of my favourite comments that I saw was that someone said, he's a reverse Mike Brearley. So, I'll let the listeners work that one out. Mm. But, I do think Stokes will continue, but there is a lot of soul searching that needs to be done between now and that next test match in June. And, with an ECB review going on, of course, the tradition after the Ashes, they have to review everything, mark their own homework. But they do need to sit down and try and work out a path forward and what that looks like.
Yeah. So McCullum said, I'd love to carry on because I feel we've got steps to take, things to improve on. I feel like we've got the makings of a good cricket team. We haven't lived up to that down here, but there are some good years in front of English cricket. Stokes said of McCullum, he's a great man, a very, very good coach. There's more that goes on behind the scenes that he'll ever give away or let out. He's got my full support. You've written a piece, Barney, saying, you know, McCullum has to go.
I don't believe that you can solve things by firing people always. I mean, Max, you know, Tottenham Hotspur, a club that exists simply to fire managers and is very good at it because it never get you anywhere. But on the other hand, I just think that cricket's problem is often, certainly in the current era, a lack of accountability, an idea that everyone basically gets away with everything. And I think that you have to hold someone to account just to send out the messaging. Also, he made loads of mistakes and admitted them. There are things that are just so slack and so no details. And you're paid a lot of money to manage the, you know, the idea that you don't want to have homework or learning or do the orthodox things is fine, but do them and then reject them. Don't just totally ignore them because you're kind of fumbling around in the dark. They have one idea, which was kind of good and made sense. But, you know, it's like they're like one of those internet influencers with a morning routine. You know, I think I've said this before, the dunking your face in an ice bath and having an avocado. And then, but what happens after that? What's your actual job? What do you do? How do we? Oh, it's just this. That's it. That's all we do.
In a way, it's an amazing comment to make after getting absolutely toweled up to say, well, I want to stay on in the job because I think there are things we can improve. Like, that's an amazing thing to say as a coach whose team's just been annihilated, is that I think I should stay there because things can get better. You know, remember Darren Lehman trying to do that for 5 minutes after the sandpaper thing in Cape Town, going, well, you know, sitting down in a informal press conference with a bunch of us in the basement of a hotel in Johannesburg by this point it was, and saying, well, we've got a problem with our culture and I think I'm the one to fix that. And we were like, well, hang on, aren't you the one who's been there for the last few years overseeing the culture that's the problem that's caused this problem? Like, where is it that you think you're the one who's going to fix that? And the detail stuff, like the thing of not having a fielding coach because he said, oh, well, it's too hard to get one because they get paid more on the T20 circuit, and so we didn't bother, and then dropping how many catches because which potentially swung the series. You know, it was a realization I had that didn't seem right, and I kind of mentally checked it, and it pans out that as bad as England were batting and bowling, they probably still would have won if they just caught all of the catches. You know, like, Australia weren't that good. Australia aren't that good. They're not that good a cricket team, particularly in the batting sphere. And England couldn't knock them off because they couldn't hang on to anything. Now, whether they have a fielding coach changes that, I don't know. But they didn't have one. How do you come into this tour that's supposed to be the thing you've been planning for almost 4 years and not have the adequate staff in place, not have the basics done, not have the nets booked at the WACA? All of that stuff. Now maybe McCullum can be there if he's got somebody else who's making him do those things, but nobody's currently making them do those things.
I like the idea there was just an under-10s team at the WACA going, sorry, we've got to put 7 till 8 and you can't have it. So Emma, you wanted to come in.
I was just thinking, like, how this is, like, really the whole narrative of the series is sort of a pretty Aristotelian tragedy, right? Because you've had the hamartia, which is like the inherent defect, the inherent kind of error in judgment in your protagonist, which is essentially, you know, Bazball and everything that they've been saying is going to work. And it stems out of hubris, which is a belief in your own superiority. And it leads to your downfall. And you've kind of mocked the gods of cricket. People die at the end of Greek tragedy. It's kind of the end. It's the end of the story. That's why I kind of find it really interesting that, you know, yeah, there's an idea that, well, we can turn this around. It's like you get to the end of Oedipus Rex and you know, like, it's the eyes are
but
out.
Now it's franchised, you see. His franchise, this Oedipus Rex 2, I can make more money out of it.
Faster and furiouser.
Yeah, just on, like, having fun, you know, McCullum's kind of, people have got to have fun. I saw someone post somewhere, Ali, and I can't remember, there was Pat Cummins and maybe Travis Head that were offered like $10 million or something to give up Test cricket and just do franchise stuff or something like that. So there is a context for McCullum needing young cricketers or needing young cricketers to enjoy Test cricket. And Test cricket is hard work, right? And we all love Test cricket. We're all middle-aged. But, like, there is trying to find that balance for a coach to say, come and do this thing. It's hard. But the, you know, if the rewards are greater, even if financially they're not necessarily greater, is there any defense there that you have to try and make this enjoyable and yet you've got to put the work in or you're not going to get anything out of it?
We've just recently had the completion of the impossibly dystopian Isle T20 in the UAE. I mean, it is one of the most bleak, soulless, plastic franchise tournaments going.
And but guys pick up huge paychecks in that. You know, it's big money, and you're going there. You know, you're in the Emirates. It's extremely low scrutiny cricket. There is no pressure. You can get four ducks in a row, and there isn't really anyone out there covering it, piling into you. You haven't got a chorus of former Australian players telling you you're weak and feckless, and that, you know, you're an absolute disgrace to your country.
There's no one to stand next to in the urinals. The urinals are empty.
So it's very good. And I don't want to say easy, because it's still cricket. You know, cricket's a hard sport, as Barney said, but it is the easier low pressure route. And that part of the outlook for England under McCullum particularly has been to basically accept that, you know, I mean, England players are paid well. Don't get me wrong. They are played well. And actually they get pretty good breaks to go and play in the IPL, and they get now a full window to play in the 100. Harry Brooks just signed a deal with Sunrisers Yorkshire, or whatever they're called, 450,000. That's on top of his England earnings. You know, they're still getting the opportunities to earn. But basically, England are having, they're trying to create an environment, or they were trying to, probably best to talk about it in the past sense, an environment where it is an enjoyable lifestyle, where it is not, you know, there is, you've only got one career. You don't want to get to the end of your career and look back at it and think, well, you know, this whole thing has passed me by, and all the experiences around the world, etc., passed me by, because I've just been so focused on cricket and so tortured by this sport, which tests you in multiple ways. The problem is on this tour is that the cricket has passed them by. I think there's going to be a lot of players in that squad, because it also does come down to personal responsibility, as much as the tone is set by the management. But I think there'll be players in the squad that will be looking in the mirror at the end of this one and thinking, man, did I give the best account of myself? Did I do everything I needed to do to get myself into the position to deliver what I do on the biggest stage? And you know, some will say that, you know, I did everything I could and I wasn't good enough. They'll accept that. But you can only look down at that squad, at some of the averages of the players leading into the series. I'm particularly looking at Brooke and Jamie Smith and guys who have underperformed. And I think, you know, I think it's going to haunt them for a while.
I agree with Ali. I think that we should take that slightly with a pinch of salt. But I think that is the context to all these discussions that we have, every mini drama, the stuff about lawn mowing and witch dunking the groundsman, everything to going to Noosa. Why did they do that? Why didn't they have proper warm ups? Why did you go to New Zealand and fight a bouncer as preparation for Perth? Which I don't know, to me doesn't seem ideal. It's basically being played out on a shrinking block of ice. You know, these are the last two polar bears, and everything at the edge is crowding this series in on itself. Why didn't you have proper preparation? I was talking to someone in the England, I guess, setup we're talking about Jacob Bethell, and we're immediately making the point that, you know, yeah, he didn't get to play, but we have an IPL deal and we can't really interfere in that. We don't want to. They don't want to displease the golden child. They do have to manage this. They can't lose the talent. It's a shrinking, we just see the series and we think, why aren't they performing like Matthew Hayden and Darren Goff? Well, that was an entirely different world. Graham Gooch could spend 3 months perfecting how not to get LBW to Terry Alderman in the indoor schools and doing nothing else. But it's just not that world anymore. And Test cricket is incredibly difficult, and you can't just walk onto the stage and sing opera out of nowhere. And that's why we've had a sloppy series that has confounded us and made us feel strange and undermined, because we are undermined, and that entire world is a kind of, you know, drowning block of ice, unfortunately.
The vested interests with the Pat Cummins $10 million story is probably more likely something to do with the fact that Cricket Australia want to sell the Big Bash, and so it's in their interest to have stories about how they need a lot more money coming in, and you know, that's the only available avenue for them to get it, and otherwise we'll all be gobbled up by the IPL. But I don't buy the idea that you have to sell Test cricket that hard, because people underestimate the fact that it is compelling. You don't have to be, it's not only middle-aged people who like it. It's not something that kids can't understand. We've had 150 years of children getting interested in long-form cricket because it's been there and it's been presented to them as a viable thing that they're allowed to be interested in. And there are, you know, I've met some of them during this series. I've met their parents. I've been introduced to kids who are into Test cricket and who like that more than the long-form stuff, and who have an investment in it in that way. So that can be done if people are willing to talk it up, if they're willing to stop being so bloody pessimistic about the thing that they like. Oh, I really love this thing and it's awful and it's unsellable and nobody could ever possibly get into it because I'm so special. I'm such a special creature that I like test cricket and I'm so weird and out there that nobody else could possibly enjoy this thing that 95,000 people just rocked up to watch 2 days in a row and would have come for a third and probably a fourth. You know, there's a real sort of self-indulgence about that kind of idea that the only people who like it are unique, special snowflakes or dinosaurs or whatever your analogy wants to be, snowflake dinosaurs, I don't know. There is a possibility to sell test cricket on the basis that it's different, it's unusual, it's unique in its own way. And players still know that you get more out of it. You get remembered and cared about for what you do in test matches in a way that you cannot possibly do when the Pal fucking Dolphins or whatever they're called play Mumbai Super Kings, Desert Cobras in whatever version of the Champions League they put together.
What time's that on, Jeff? I'm actually really looking forward to that. That's going to be amazing.
It's a good point you make. Like, I spoke to Matt Pryor on the radio the other day and he was basically saying, talk about this exact thing and still, you know, that memory of sitting on the SCG pitch having won the Ashes and that, you know, pint, that righteous pint. Mm-hmm. They sat around and they all talked about the sacrifices that they've made, which is sort of, it's quite an elite sport thing to do. No real people ever sit around going, oh, I really broke my back to do this podcast or whatever. But no, it was a righteous pint. And like this, like when you've earned that, when you've deserved that pint, that's much more than the number of pints that Harry Brooke had before not being allowed in a nightclub, right? You know, in New Zealand. So Ali, what do you think the setup will look like? It feels like Rob Key and McCollum are staying in the moment.
Yeah, I mean, we've mentioned it before, but it's this T20 World Cup that is kind of sat there, and because it's so close and that England essentially have the England players going to that tournament or certainly going on that white ball leg of the winter, they've got 9 days at home and then they turn around and head to Sri Lanka. So that just means that any change is unlikely to be forthcoming until the end of that tournament. What does the future... to be honest, I don't know, because what is so interesting and sort of slightly depressing on one level is that this is a real kind of nexus. You know, cricket is a very small world and it involves a lot of very close relationships and people who are kind of, you know, pegged to each other. And essentially, McCollum is Key's man. You know, Key is the team director there. He's appointed Andrew Flintoff as the Lions coach. Andrew Flintoff is a client of MC Saatchi, on the board of which is the ECB chair, Richard Thompson. It's a very small world, cricket, and that removing one piece will probably see a lot of pieces fall away. It's hard to see what the kind of end product looks like there. Having said that, if it is to remain with McCollum in charge, there are vacancies, as Jeff mentioned. You know, there are spots in that backroom staff. He has made a virtue of trying to pare back the backroom staff, reduce the number of noises, reduce the number of bodies in the dressing room. And there's some merit to that, I'm sure, on some level. But it's also sort of meant there's been a lack of technical precision and specialism in the backroom staff. And while that was a good thing for your Wokeses and your Bairstows and your Broads and your Andersons who are coming towards the end of their careers and were absolutely, you know, they know their games. They are hardened professional cricketers. It's the young guys that this setup is letting down, I think, because there seems to be a belief that if you get into the test team, you've made it, you're good enough, you've shown you're good enough, do what you've already done to get there. That's just not the case. There is still masses of room for improvement. Duncan Fletcher knew that. Andy Flower knew that. And, so I'd expect, even if there's no sort of overall regime change, I'd expect to see some more specialism coming into the backroom staff and it to slightly expand again.
All right, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll talk about Australia.